You're listening to the Outclassed podcast with Mike Redding and Blake Seifert, exploring excellence in teaching, tech, and leadership.
Hi, Mike. It's a pleasure to be back with you today. I'm excited to talk about a few things around, again, this distance learning topic that's been coming up a lot in the news, and obviously schools grappling with now, and where I am, schools grappling with at least a term of remote learning. There's going to be lots to talk about today. But what are you up to, Mike? You're still in isolation?
Yep, still in isolation. Good old New Zealand, still locked down and not going anywhere. It's actually a bit of a cold and wet day, a bit of snow on the mountains today. So it's a good day to be inside recording a podcast, actually.
Yeah, that view of the Remarkables from your house, it's nice.
Yeah.
So I guess I'll jump straight into our guest today. This is our first guest on the podcast. We've got Caitlin Halliwell here. And Caitlin's been a long friend of mine, friend of the show as well. And she's had a big history with working remotely and online, trying to deliver classes and teaching online. She's tutored online for 3 years. She's managed distance learning program for the government, including a team of 60 teachers, and has worked at Swinburne University supporting university lecturers with distance learning technologies. So we're hoping to learn a lot from her today on what we might be doing wrong when we're pivoting our schools to this online and distance learning. And Caitlin, welcome to the show. Thanks for agreeing at such short notice.
Thank you. That's fine. Thanks for having me.
No worries. Do you want to just maybe give a quick rundown of your history? I know I gave you a little intro there about, but just sort of what you've been focused on in terms of the distance learning side of things.
Sure. I guess I've always had an interest in technology throughout my teaching career. So I was always looking for opportunities to develop online curriculum, including working in a brand new school where much of the curriculum was online. And so I've then sort of sought out opportunities to work more in an online space because I think it's a really interesting dynamic, I guess, when you've got students that you're not physically located with. Often you get to do more one-on-one work, which means you really can connect with the student and see where they're at, which is really important and has that benefit over classroom teaching. I think that you make those you spend more time one-on-one with students, so you make those connections a bit better.
Absolutely. And I think there's a lot of challenges, and I know, Mike, in your position, you're getting a lot of questions, sort of common questions you're seeing over and over again. Do you want to sort of talk to some of those?
Yeah, I'm just really interested in the comment you made there that you get to spend more time with students, not less. What was the average class size that you were working with?
It's interesting because I think this is the first time that people are really being asked to teach primary and secondary students online. So a lot of the work I was doing were with adults, where it is a bit different. And most of it was actually one-to-one. We did do some small group classes that were more interactive and they worked quite well as well, particularly in the government program I was managing, because that was migrants who'd come to Australia and were learning English. So to have that conversational component was really interesting. Mm. But I think that it's a different ball game now, actually, trying to teach junior students, even junior secondary students, in comparison to seniors. I think I'll certainly be looking at doing things quite differently for my juniors and seniors in terms of the amount of work and how that's structured online, how much of it they're doing in a self-paced way. But one of the things I'm really going to be focusing on is checking in with each student each week one-on-one, because I think that's going to be the important thing to keep those connections up. Because you can't just transfer what you do in the classroom with 26 students to suddenly delivering to 26 students online in an online classroom. It's not the same thing. It's not possible, especially because we're imagining we'll be turning off webcams and controlling the audio of students so that there aren't connection issues. So yes, it's going to be quite different. I'm imagining that I'm going to do a live class each week to set students up with what they're going to be working on each week, check in with any questions about the work that's being set, but we'll be largely using online collaborative tools, I think, to work remotely, and then I'll be either chatting, emailing, or video calling individual students depending on the level of support and help they need.
And that's one thing I wanted to pick up on when we had this initial conversation. You were saying it's going to be a lot more work for you, you know, and that kind of was interesting, because what I hear a lot is schools saying, oh, we're just going to pick up what we had and then use it, you know, like normal. Like we'll just say, well, we already have these plans online, these forms online. We'll just shoot those out to the kids and they can hand them in. What's the difference? So I'm keen to just unpack where that work will be. Like what's going to add all this work? Do we have to rebuild curriculum? Are we just checking in with kids? Like what does that work look like?
I think that online pedagogy is quite different from face-to-face. So we rely on being able to walk around a classroom when we're face-to-face and look over a student's shoulder and see what they're doing, or notice whether they're engaged or not. And that gives us a lot of information about how they're coping with the work and whether they're understanding. And we're able to sit down beside them and actually help them with that work to get them going or answer the questions at the point of need. So when you're moving online, you have to find ways to replicate that interactivity that we have in the classroom, and so there are lots of different ways you can do that, but you certainly can't just pick up what you have done. I think we'll be teaching the same content but in a different way. So my plan is to create video tutorials for my senior classes for content that I would have taught face to face. Short snippets breaking down particular skill sets, showing them how I would approach a task. And then we've already been using OneNote all year, but my plan is to push out a formative feedback template for them for each week that they fill in, where they actually go through the steps to complete the task themselves. And as part of that, I'm going to have a space for them at the bottom to put their comments on what they found difficult or any questions they'd like answered. And then there's a box underneath that. So I'll actually go into their work each week, have a look, give some feedback, and they'll be able to access that in real time as well.
Right. So just to kind of summarize that. So short video topics. So you're going to have to sort of break those topics into short little video grabs or some kind of online format. Formative feedback and live and some sort of live space to collaborate with the kids, right? So you can see what they're doing, where they're up to.
Yeah. So I'm thinking I'll do a video or an actual live intro during we're using Microsoft Teams. So we'll continue to use that as a platform. So live intros to the work each week, if we want to do brainstorms to share ideas, we'll be able to do that in discussion pages as well. Trying to keep some sense of interactivity and community within the class as well, because students might be feeling a bit isolated.
And how do you do that? Through video or a whole bunch of tools?
Yeah, I think through a whole bunch of tools. So I'd be thinking, well, what are the sorts of things that we would talk about in class and how can we maybe replicate that online, either live or in an asynchronous way. Students, have to post on a particular discussion topic each week or on a particular day as part of what we're talking about, and then we share those in the next live class we're doing. So, yeah, I guess my approach is to think about what I would normally do in class, think about what the purpose of that activity is, and then think about the technology that's best going to support that same purpose. And that might mean that I deliver the session in a totally different way, but it will deliver the same sort of learning outcome.
Mm. One of the things that's interesting from what I've observed, especially with the use of tools like Google Classroom, is they often get used as blast platforms, like broadcast platforms rather than collaborative platforms. where you'll say, okay, I'm going to tell you, here's the work, here's the resources, here's the stuff. And then no one's ever expecting to have a discussion in those platforms. And I'm keen to hear from you, like what are the things that teachers need to do to kind of inspire that community approach and that discussion kind of first approach? Like all these platforms have the ability to comment, talk backwards and forwards, and to do even do small formative assessment and polls and things like that. What should you do? Should you be saying, how's your day? Or should you keep it on topic? Like what are the ways you can kind of keep that community in the classroom?
I think the key is not to think it's going to happen automatically, because I think as a teacher, you actually will have to plan for that. So, you know, I'm thinking I teach Year 7 history. And so one of the things we would normally do in class during our discussion time is think about, well, we're just about to start ancient Rome. We would think about all of the different topics that they might like to research for their research project on ancient Rome. And so everyone would come up with things that they know about ancient Rome and share that as a class, and we do a big brainstorm on the board. So, I mean, we could either do that in a live class, but I'm actually thinking of starting a discussion board and everyone jots down their ideas, and then that's sitting there so students can go back when they're trying to choose a topic that they're interested in, can actually go back to that discussion board and have a look through. And you know, it sort of saves students having to take notes while you're having that discussion as well. It's capturing what's going on or what people are saying in a bit of a different format.
So when you're saying discussion board, just so I can visualise that, are you talking about like a OneNote page that everyone's put their ideas into, or a whiteboard inside a Teams channel? Or
yeah, so I was thinking about just a chat in a Teams channel for that particular activity. But one of the things I do actually in the classroom with my Year 11s is I teach Year 11 English. So one of the things we'll do is any collaborative work that you might have previously done on a poster, where you sit in a group and you come up with quotes on a theme or quotes and evidence regarding a particular character in a text, I'll actually get students to do that online. So still split them into groups, but they have a collaborative space in their OneNote, and I'll create a OneNote page for each theme and then and a table, and actually specify the information in there. So, you know, page number, the theme, who's saying what to who, and what's the actual quote and why is it significant. And so in that way, you're creating a bank of collaborative knowledge that the students have access to, and it doesn't involve them doing the work twice. They don't have to do it on a poster and then it has to be scanned, or if they're not in the classroom, they can't see it on the wall. So it's thinking about how to shift those collaborative activities you would do in class already into the online space using whatever tools. I mean, schools will be using a host of different tools. So it's thinking about what you've got at your fingertips and how you might utilise that, I think.
Mm. Yeah, I've seen some really good examples of Microsoft Teams to do that, where you can spin up a channel and have meet breakout rooms going at the same time, and then collect all that data and the chat and the whiteboards or the OneNote links are in there. And
then yeah,
coming back to those groups. So I think teachers are definitely starting to think about that. How do we get students collaborating, but almost publicly in a sense, not behind the scenes where we can't see what they're doing? How do we track the data on that? What does that look like?
Yeah.
Some really interesting ways to bring all of that together.
Yeah, and there really is a big question there about what you do live in a synchronous way with everybody participating at the one time, and what you choose to do in a self-paced, here's what you need to get through this week, do it when you can sort of fashion. So schools and individual teachers will be having to make decisions too about what they think is the benefit in hosting particular activities online live, and what would be more beneficial for students to work on in their own time. Because we know in the classroom that students are always at different points in the task. Some students work more quickly than others. And so, yeah, I think that's going to be an interesting tension too. What do you actually choose to put online? What do you choose to bring the students together to do? And what do you to what extent do you facilitate them working at their own pace?
It's interesting because my kids are in an online school, and I, you know, one of the things I think about, like my son's public holiday today, but he's doing schoolwork now, and he'll work at night, but then he doesn't have to be at school tomorrow, in inverted commas. So teachers who are bringing a traditional pedagogy to an online learning sometimes will miss the opportunity to let their students spend more time, less time, different time working on that. If you're requiring them to be at, you know, online at 9 a.m. in the morning every day for a check-in, maybe that's not the best way to go about this.
It's interesting. It's sort of like remote work in that sense where, you know, a lot of remote work, they're saying, I want you to check in every day and, you know, you've got to be on deck at a certain time versus the outcome, rather than that sort of bum on a seat 9 to 5, are you at your desk? Now it's more about, are you actually getting the outcome done? So that's a bit of a mind shift, but I just want to revisit a little bit about pacing there you were talking about. One of the things that we're seeing is like teachers want to know how far in advance they should push things, because now obviously you could just share the entire term's curriculum with the kids and say, all right, good luck, I've done my job, see you later. Obviously that's probably not the best approach, but what do you think about pacing? Should it just be similar to what you would do when you're teaching your class, or do you want to sort of make sure that there is somewhere for the kids who are, you know, at the top of your class to extend to, and there's also some slack in the system for students who are struggling that need sort of more support and more time?
Yeah, I think there's a few things to think about there. So I'll be aiming to keep my students together on a week-by-week basis. I think if you drop the whole term's worth of work on students, then you don't have any ability. A kid might go through in a week and do all the work and say, I'm done, and you've got no opportunity to scaffold how they approach that task and to what level of detail they approach the task. And it's very difficult when a kid thinks they're done to get them to go back and add more detail information into something. I think you also need to think about how you're going to check in with students and make sure that they're doing something, that they understand the task and that they're working. So you've always got those kids in class that speed ahead and get everything done really quickly, and for those kids that will be great. There might be an opportunity to put some extra do this if you feel like it sort of tasks, enrichment style tasks on there. But I think that it's an opportunity for the kids that work more quickly to have more time to themselves, and that's a benefit. I don't know if all the parents would agree with that, but that's another thing entirely. And I think then...
Well, let's find out, actually. Mike, what are you, your kids are homeschooled, or not homeschooled, but online schooled. What do you think about them having more free time? Like if they're just boating around all day with nothing to do, is that a good positive thing, or is it a problem for you?
I don't have a problem with it, so long as the underlying mentality in it is that done doesn't mean learnt. So if you've got these kids who are racing through their tasks because they want to just play Xbox for the rest of the day, and if they can show mum and dad I've done all my work, you know, let me have some Xbox time, then, you know, so long as they're not just racing through so they can tick a box, and, you know, it's the equivalent of back in the day when you used to smash through a maths assignment or something so you could go out to lunch early, or you know, it doesn't mean that you actually learnt the task. So I think there's a bit of a balance in that. But, I mean, at the end of the day, I don't have a problem with them. If they've got through their work in an hour a day, then, you know, what else could they be doing with that time? I'd be trying to point them towards a little bit of entrepreneurship or...
Yeah, something that they're really interested in pursuing in their own right. I think what's going to be important, and particularly with the weaker students too, is formative feedback. So my plan is that pretty much for every task I set, I'm going to want to see that in some way or look at the learning. And it might not be something that I then have to provide feedback on, because I think that would be very onerous. Mm. But the equivalent of sort of walking around your classroom and checking in on your students might be to use Microsoft Forms to do a 2 or 3 question survey that's just assessing actual knowledge or the ability to answer a particular set of questions. You might get them to write a little sample introduction or a sample body paragraph and have a look at that. And you might not provide detailed feedback, but it's a way of just making sure that students are on track, because I think that's going to be one of the challenges, making sure that you could have students that actually don't log on at all in a week. And if you don't catch that until week three, and then there's 3 weeks of work that they need to catch up on, that's going to be an issue. So you have to have those systems in place, I think, to catch the kids that are struggling and then communicate home, or they might be the ones that you target for a one-to-one online, so you can actually talk them through the activities as well.
Yeah, definitely. Teams and Google Docs both have activity trackers in them. So in a Google Doc, you can click the little activity bar and it tells you what's been happening in that doc. And same in Teams. If you click on a chat with a student, it tells you the activity right up the top. What have they been doing? When were they last logged in? So you can get a bit of a sense and take a bit of a temperature check of where things are at. But the whole assessment thing has been like so asked so many times. We just did a big training for South Australian independent schools. It was a number one question. I think teachers have kind of got their head around formative assessment a little bit and getting some ideas of how that happens. But there's a whole lot of questions around summative assessment right now. What does that look like? And how do you stop cheating? And I don't know, have you had any experience with that or got any thoughts that go down that path?
Yeah, look, I think that's one of the most challenging questions. Certainly formative assessment is quite easy online, in my opinion. Summative assessment is a bit more difficult, particularly with senior students, when you want to be able to verify their work. And I think that that's where I would be looking at a lot of smaller tasks done over the course of the whole topic, rather than maybe just one task at the end, because unless you've actually got some online invigilation software, which does exist but is probably not really practical for this circumstance, it'd be very difficult to ensure that students are not using other people's information or notes or brothers or sisters' work. Getting parents on board might help with that as well, getting them to sort of invigilate a task, but that might not be practical either. So I think there still is a question there around that, you know, the types of things that you would actually have as a timed task under strict supervision. There is still a bit of a challenge there, I think.
I think the kids will... The good kids will probably do the right thing, and it'll be the kids whose parents are disengaged in their schooling that won't be around to help them. That's kind of a challenge. But I wonder, with that, you're saying setting smaller tasks. I think that's a great idea, just breaking it down so it's hard of them to kind of just say, all right, I just got to get my cheating in order for this one session. This way I can just, you know, get rapid hit with smaller amounts all through the year and get a better picture of where they're at.
Because then if they do cheat in a big assessment, you've probably got more of an idea because you've seen their work the whole way through too.
Yeah, and I'm also thinking about SACS and this kind of stuff and how we stop cheating. Like one of the things we're using, because we're a Chromebook school, we've got Google locked forms. And of course, okay, that locks your Chromebook out, but you can pick your mobile phone up and sit around and, you know, Google it all and answer all the questions. But
yeah.
But I just wonder if setting a locked form in itself is enough of an expectation, or is at least going to send the message that, hey, this is a locked thing. If you're going to cheat, you're going to cheat. We've had cheating in tests since they were invented. But I wonder if that's enough to kind of set the expectation that this is a formal summative assessment rather than a casual little formative feedback session. So what are your thoughts on that?
I guess anything you do to reinforce the expectations is helpful. I mean, I wonder whether we think about, for this term, by and large, if it's something that really would normally have been done under exam conditions, whether or not we're just looking at S's and not actual grades. And obviously, that doesn't work for Year 12, but it works for other year levels. I think this is an exceptional circumstance, and if we were to move secondary schooling or primary schooling online in any sort of long-term way, you would come up with ways of doing that, and that might actually even be to get students to come in on particular days, or send, you know, have little assessment centres around the place if that was really important. But I think people need to remember at the moment, or in my opinion really, this is an exceptional circumstance. Got parents at home trying to work from home and help their kids study from home. You've got kids whose whole lives have been turned upside down as well, who suddenly isolated and can't do any of the things they would normally do. So I'm erring on the side of make it a bit easier for everyone and, you know, make some exceptions in these exceptional circumstances. I think we're trying to do a lot and everybody's already dealing with a lot. So now would not be the time to make things more difficult for yourself, would be mine.
Yeah, but then you've also got universities who are looking at entrance, and you can't say to a university, well, there's going to be no year one entrance next year because we don't know how to sort out a requirement to get into uni, because that, I mean, that's billions of dollars to a university to push that back a year. So yeah, you've got people already looking at it. We were even joking the other day, like, even if you had a proctored exam, if it's a high stakes exam, you can't, not just the kids with disengaged parents, it's the students with parents who are like on their kids, because you could, you know, you take a proctored exam and you have to show your room and under the table and make sure there's no devices. But I can see a parent just sliding an iPad under the door sort of thing, you know? So I think there is an answer, but that whole flow onto university and TAFE sector, and how do you compete for university entrance when there is no summative, well, hard summative assessments? That's a whole nother headache. I'd hate to be making some decisions on that sort of thing.
I know it is tricky. And I think what came to mind just then when you were talking for me as well, is that we're also talking about inequality in student access to technology as well in these circumstances. I know schools are making detailed lists of students that don't have access to technology and trying to make sure that they do have the access that they need to be successful this term. But assessment, again, is a whole other ball game. And it's interesting because I've often thought about how the university system, I guess, work out their own means or ways of ranking students or assessing their suitability for university, because at the moment the restrictive nature of year 11 and year 12, that really narrow curriculum focus, is solely to produce this enter or this university entrance ranking at the end of year 12 that a lot of students don't even need or want, because they're not intending to go to university. I just think if suddenly, I mean, this has been a very disruptive crisis, I guess, but with disruption comes opportunity, I think. And so, you know, maybe this is a time to think about how that could be done differently, because most teachers, when you talk to them, love the fact that in junior years you've got more freedom to teach students views and values and how to think and how to be entrepreneurial and how to make their way out in the world, in a world that's ever changing. And then, you know, by the time we get to year 11 and year 12, we've got such a narrow focus on this predefined skill set to get this external ranking. You know, imagine what we could be doing if we didn't have those restrictions in the type of curriculum that we're mandated to teach.
Yeah, 100%.
There are kind of two remedies to that we already have, like two instruments we already have. One of those would be folios. So for art degrees and things like that, where we're providing folio work. The only thing I find with that is, again, that's sort of an equality issue as well, because a lot of people I know who do tutoring and things like that often end up doing some of, if not all of, the folios. You know, we'll have retired art professors and artists who are, you know, helping students at year 12 do folio work that's like 10 years ahead of where they're at. So we have this sort of false economy of folios, if you like, and everyone's forced down the road of getting someone to help them do it because you can't compete otherwise. So there's the folio entrance, which is one way, which has its flaws. And then there's IB. And I've never worked in an IB school. So I'm interested to hear from Mike, maybe, how does that stack up? Like, is that a good alternative? Like, how would that work with university, you know, people stepping up into university and those kind of things?
Yeah, potentially. I wonder if this is not an opportunity for education to just get over the whole idea of equality and inequality anyway. Like, that is a reality of life. If education has been designed as a conveyor belt where we're meant to churn out students who are all the same and equal, and we realize this is not really serving us as a community and as a society, maybe we just need to let the cards fall where they may a little bit and see if we can't come up on another system like that. You know, I talk to some university lecturers, I try and pick fights with them on Twitter every now and then because they'll talk about their wonderful university programs that once you're in year two or year three, there's no exams. It's all on the job training and you get, you know, reports back from your workplace. But I'm like, but to still get into university, I've still got to get a certain grade to get in before I can be like that. So, you know, and then once you're on the job, there's no two jobs are equal. So how do you, you know, you might have one boss who's a real bugger and you've got another guy who's like super soft. And so, you know, and they're both providing feedback and marks to the university as to how well you're going as a student. So I don't know. I think maybe we need to look even a bit beyond something like an IB framework, which is a little bit looser in terms of how students get there. But, you know, in terms, you know, some cases the outcomes are kind of the same. I don't know if that's a little bit controversial or, you know, how teachers would react to that. But, you know, there's a lot to be said with students who can bypass the whole university system and go and just cut that whole process out and go straight to a job and start earning good money and build a career based on their portfolio of work, not from a piece of paper, which no one ever looks at again.
Yeah, they're 4 to 10 years ahead. Yeah. I think there are caveats to that, though. Like if you want to be a doctor, for instance, there's significant, I don't think you can sort of entrepreneur your way into a surgeon's position, but, and for good reason. Sorry?
Maybe you should be able to, though.
Okay, I'll tee that up for your next surgery, Mike. Well, maybe you should be able to. That's an interesting idea. But I do think there is a purpose when it's a process-driven industry. Something like, you know, surgery, for instance. There's limited creativity in those endeavors. It's about doing what's best practice and what's, you know, has the best odds of survival. So they're quite procedural. It's sort of like being an aircraft pilot. You go through a very procedural process, and you know this, Mike, used to fly light aircraft, wasn't it, out of Nowra? Mm. And it's all books, isn't it? It's all if this, then that. I need to memorize, you know. So that's a familiar thing that schools have been doing for a long time. But it does become a problem when you're talking about 21st century learning and moving into knowledge-based work, where it's going to be how do we compete? How do we do things better? How do we come up with new ideas? How do we, you know, take existing models and transform them? That kind of thinking, I'm not so sure. And this has always been my view, is that the schools aren't really creating great opportunities for students to embrace that, especially at the high end of senior school, which is the time they need to embrace that, because that's the time they're closest to actually doing the work. So, yeah, I mean, it's interesting, but like, what does that look like, Mike? You're saying, is that more of a folio approach, or you're saying it's closer to IB? Like, what do those ideas kind of look like?
Yeah, I think it is. I think it's folio. I think it's work experience. I think it's demonstrated capabilities. Like my biggest thing is just say you've got this student who's an amazing engineer, can build great things in the backyard, you know, has got a real mind for building systems, processes, that's got ADD, can't sit still in school for love or money, can't do well on a test because they get into a test and they freeze. And so they're locked out of an engineering degree because they didn't get the end of school mark that they need for that particular course, but would be an amazing engineer. So I think there needs to be something that shows competence on the job, or, you know, competence to learn quickly around that. I mean, I used to work in pathology and I used to work in a hospital, and so I know the hospital system really well. And I got 100% in my blood banking exam. So, you know, cross-matching blood and giving blood transfusion. But I haven't worked in pathology for 20 years. If you asked me to do that right now, I'd kill someone. So there's a whole, like, this is where I wrestle even with my own kids. Like, learnt doesn't mean ability to be able to do things, and it certainly doesn't mean retention down the track. And, you know, when you're working in a hospital situation, you learn more from being next to a doctor in a situation than you ever would from a textbook, which, by the way, are all out to date by the time you get to actually practice it. I remember sitting in a university lecture on neurophysiology and all about the brain and what you couldn't do in the brain. And then you get into the hospital and they go, no, that's not right. We've learnt since then that everything you just learnt at university is completely outdated, and not just outdated, but actually wrong. So I think when you step back and you have a look at this, somehow there needs to be an aptitude test, or some way that, it can't just be a one-size-fits-all approach. There needs to be some flexibility to be able to look at students based on merit. So whether that's interview, whether that's write an application, whether that's demonstrate via some form of media, like a portfolio. I don't have the answers to it, but, yeah. I'm like right now wrestling with it because I've got a daughter who's 1-2 years away from uni, and I'm like, I don't even know that I wanted to go, to be honest, because I think she could just shortcut the whole process and way ahead of but at the same time, the traditionalist teacher in me says this is the pathway that you've got to walk. So, yeah, I don't know. I've got more questions than answers.
There's a massive tension there.
There is. There's a great visual of, a page with a whole lot of dots on it, and all those dots represent knowledge. And then there's a page where all the dots are connected, and that represents experience. So, like, you're going to learn as you get experience, but it's about not just knowing that, like you said, is learning the information. Can I multiply? Yes, but I have some experience in the industry of where I need to multiply. Suddenly that multiplication skill becomes super important. I need to use it a lot, and therefore I can connect those things together and understand why I need them. And I'm a big proponent of that. And like, I think that school does fail a lot of people, particularly in the ways you're talking, but particularly as well around just regional demographics about, you're the top of your class in a bad school. And then you go, you think, I'm doing a great job here. Then you don't really compete up the road where you've got, all really highly academic kids. How are you kind of bringing those worlds together? And I think we have this opportunity now with online learning that we can bring those things together and bring everyone up, if you like, bring the whole lot up. And it's not just about traditional academia. Like, I've had this harebrained idea for like a school that kind of has a microcosm of capitalism sitting inside of it, where everyone has to do work. So you've got to like work at the canteen, you've got to work at with the grounds crew, you've got to work with the pedagogy teaching people sections, and the teachers behave as like the government. So they don't do much work really, they just provide policy and governance and safety and all those kind of things. And I think that'd be a great way for what you were saying, Mike, is to kind of demonstrate that knowledge of, well, how did you perform when you were doing food safety in the canteen? How did you perform when you were doing construction? You had to do maths and understand those kind of principles. And of course, there's still a place for academic work and for learning process and your traditional book work. But I think that's probably less of a focus now than it ever has been in the past.
Yeah, I think that's a perfect model for a school. I've often said, like, if we were going to ever build a school, it'd be one where the students had to work in industry as part of their curriculum plan. So you'd have, in a place like Queenstown, an event centre, and they're running all the events, the lighting, the staging, the ticketing, the sales, like, so then you've got all your numeracy and all your literacy and, critical thinking and feedback loops and collaborate, like, all of that starts getting built through those particular skills, and the school is then serving the community in an authentic way. So I think, there's lots of opportunities to reimagine education right now, but I think everyone just needs a moment just to get their head back above water and,
That's true. You probably shouldn't try to entirely restructure the education system off the back of this term, but it's definitely an interesting time to take a pause and think, what could we be doing better and what opportunities does this afford us, I think, to
Well, it'd be the worst case scenario is you're going to go back in a term, what, 10, 12 weeks, and everything's going to go back to how it was before. That would be a disaster. You've got teachers that have created all this online content. The last thing you want to do is for them to put it in a virtual filing cabinet and never touch it again. Surely we could be doing things with flipped classes next year and repurposing content and using it for assessment and revision later on. And so hopefully teachers are taking the opportunity to think a little bit beyond the next 3 months to, okay, if I did a task now and I did it well, what would that look like next month, next term, next year, and so on.
I wonder if it is up to the teachers though, Mike, because you know, we can try and change the system internally and try and do, you know, things more progressively. But if the structure like that ATAR, you know, is still in place, or that the school's traditional instructional model is in place, which, you know, shows good results and is the best thing that you can do for those students to give them the best chance of getting into university, which gives them the most options in life. That's where I think the struggle will be. I don't think there's any doubt out of this, we're going to have much better skill sets of staff for remote learning. I think everyone is going to pick up a skill, whether it's using Google Classroom, whether it's doing flipped classroom or using video more powerfully or getting better at video. But I think it's when we come back, those tools are going to be in the toolbox. It's whether the schools decide to use them. That's where I'm not sure. I'm keen to hear what you guys think about it, whether it will happen or it won't happen, or whether we'll just, you know, it'll be a blip on the radar in 2 years and we'll think, oh, remember that time we taught from home?
That's really interesting, because I think this is the first time really that we've had this massive forced upskilling in somewhat of a panicked way in a lot of circumstances, because it's been very last minute of an entire teacher cohort, you know, and as you said, people are learning skills that they may have thought previously were not relevant to them, and so they would never have bothered to learn a whole lot of the technology that they'll be now forced to use out of necessity. So it's interesting to think about what sort of flexibility that might give us in terms of timetabling, you know, next year and beyond. And do students have to be in class for five periods a week face to face, or can there be split components? And do you have particular cohorts of kids that opt to do a partly online curriculum or a wholly online curriculum? It's interesting to think, because it's opened up those opportunities. And look, I guess part of it depends on the experience people have too when they're actually doing online learning. There'll be people who find it really uncomfortable and who really struggle with it, and who probably come out at the end of this term and think, I don't ever want to do that again, and that it doesn't work. And then there'll be others who manage to translate their classroom teaching into an amazing online curriculum and who love it and actually can see that it's a really beneficial way to move forward. So it's an interesting discussion to have.
And I know I've got to get to wins and fails in a sec, Mike, but just quickly, this is from my perspective as the IT manager looking after, you know, 200 staff and 2,200 kids. What is my focus? My focus is right now on easing any friction, making sure that if kids have any problems that we solve those so that teachers aren't running into roadblocks remotely, because, and to do that in a kind of exceptional way, not in a, well, this is the policy, you know, you can't have a spare device or whatever. We're sort of saying, well, let's just give everyone the best opportunity we can right now, because the first impression we make now, I feel, is going to be the most important one for having any chance of this stuff lifting off the ground in the next, you know, few years when things do settle down.
Definitely.
That's my little 2 cents.
Yeah, well, and enabling staff as well who are creative and have ideas about how they can do things, enabling them with the technology they need to be able to do that well, because it'll be those experiences that we learn a lot from as well.
Yeah, and I mean, we're talking to an IT team from a fairly exclusive high school in Australia, and they're seeing the opportunity right now. So they're a very direct instructional kind of school. It gets the results they want, but they're like, right, we've seen the light. We can record every single one of our classrooms moving forward. We can take all of those video recordings. We can make them searchable so students can go back and find information that was shared in a lesson. All of that information can be fed into AI, and we can create chatbots. And so they're starting to think big. They're going, okay, we've got all this data. How are we going to improve teaching and learning on the back end of this? So they're seeing it from an IT infrastructure point of view. What do they need to do to enable this? But then from a teaching and learning point of view, what can we do with all this data that we're all of a sudden putting all online? All of our courses are online. All of our videos are online. Well, let's not just put them there and forget about it. Where's the second mile in that? Seeing what sort of results you can get. I think you'll find that there will be some schools, even though they're quite traditional in their approach, that will be able to leverage technology to push that even further.
Yeah, and hopefully this is a great pivot point for that we won't ever go back to doing things exactly the same way as we did, because we see the opportunities in maybe not wholesale online learning that we're being forced to do at the moment, but picking up elements of what's working really well and rolling that out in a more structured way.
Well, wins and fails this week, Mike. Anything on your radar? Anything you've seen that's good, bad, ugly?
To be honest, this week I've been kind of head down, bums up, trying to get through a whole bunch of project work with schools. But I have noticed a couple of things are coming out in the media in New Zealand in particular. So unlike you guys, like your premier came out and said, we're probably going to shut schools till the end of the term. So when is that for you guys? We're talking end of May, early June, right? And
this is week one, and it's an 11-week term, I think. So
into the middle of the year. But Australia is not officially locked down. New Zealand, on the other hand, is officially locked down. You can't go anywhere, do anything except for go to the supermarket. But yet they're saying as soon as we come out of level four lockdowns, which potentially could be a week and a half or so, that schools may start to start to gradually roll out again, and as early as the end of, like, in 3 weeks' time, at the end of April. So, but I'm also looking on the back end. There. Yeah. Looking on the back end of that, the New Zealand government have just bought or leased 70,000 devices to give to students who don't have them across the country. So, on one hand, I'm kind of thinking this is not going to be a short-term solution. If you're buying 70,000 devices, you want to get some use out of those. But at the same time, they're trying to give, I guess, some sort of level of surety that we will come out of this.
Mike, are you suggesting that one part of the government is not talking to another part of the government?
Well, who would know?
That's interesting. It'd be hard as a teacher. Like, let me ask you this. If you were still in the classroom, would you run out and plan the whole term online? Or would you be thinking, oh, we'll just wait and see?
I'd be thinking online, but I wouldn't be thinking this term. I'd be thinking long term, me personally.
Yeah, but I reckon a lot of people would think, let's just wait and see, and then be kind of scrambling in 3 or 4 weeks when they run out of their prep work. It makes it very hard, I think. If you want to do it well, you've got to really do it up front and look at it.
Yeah, definitely. I think 80% of the teaching population are just hanging on by their fingernails, waiting for this thing to be over.
We've at least been given some certainty, I guess, knowing that it will likely be the whole term. And so we're actually planning, once we get the topic with our seniors, we're in the middle of a topic. Once that topic's ended, we'll be planning in year level groups so that there's some consistency around the content we're creating and sharing and our approach. So that's sharing the load. You're not expected to do all of that on your own, which is really good. But if you didn't know how long you might be teaching online for, that would be a bit more difficult.
Well, I've got a couple of wins and fails, and the first one is I realized I had someone email me over the Easter weekend who got locked out of their account, one of my staff, and I've realized now how detrimental that's going to be, especially in schools that aren't, that haven't moved that much online, that are suddenly forced into it, but don't have that structure, that the kind of supports in place to manage it. Because if you get locked out over a long weekend, over 4 days, and you're planning on doing some work, you literally can't do anything. Whereas it's not like the old days where you probably had some forms that you'd got the kids to fill out with paper that were sitting around. Whereas now there's just nothing to do at all. So that's a bit of a fail there of, like, making sure we've got those supports in place. In terms of a win, this is a bit of a side topic that I've been tracking it's a win and a fail, I guess, but depending on how you look at it. I noticed in the news, Google and Apple are now working together on a COVID app that will use Bluetooth to track where you've been all day for 40, up to 40 days. And it will do it anonymously, supposedly, and data will be deleted after 40 days, supposedly. And that if you travel near someone and then you activate it and say, I've got now got COVID, and I think, I don't know if healthcare do this or you do this, it's a bit unclear, that it tracks everyone you've been in contact with and they all get notified and they have to isolate as well. And of course, there's heaps of little issues around whether that works. You know, the person who's on the other side of the wall also gets notified even though they never saw you and don't have any risk factors. But I thought that was really good in one sense, is that it lets economies start back up in a way that kind of can, you know, help stem the infection rates. If it does kind of break out again, you can say, well, we know who you came in contact with. But it really does seem Orwellian in the sense that we now have companies and government kind of controlling a lot of information, a lot of where we go, a lot of what we do. And these two big companies, Apple and Google, working together, I thought was interesting as well. You don't often see that, all for the greater good. But I'm always reminded that if you know, let's say the KGB, the NSA and ASIO all got together and tried to invent the best possible way to track people around the globe, they couldn't, if in their wildest dreams, have imagined something like Facebook. And I just wonder whether this is an extension of that. And it raises a lot of questions around privacy and the efficacy of it. And how much do we trust these companies to not mess it up and not allow bad actors into the system to cause mayhem? Yeah.
It's a bit scary, isn't it? It's almost Black Mirror-ish, where it's got a good intent, but it also can be skewed one way. I know last week, Google released all the data to the New Zealand government on people's movements. And that's right, they do track me kind of moment, where they were saying, you know, we've seen across the country that trips to the supermarket have increased X amount of percent, but trips to your work have decreased so many. And they are monitoring everything. They know down to the meter where you are, how long you've stayed there. And for the fact that they would say, oh, we'll delete it after 40 days, that 40 days worth of data is like a gold mine of information, right? How long did you stay in a certain area? Who did you meet with? Like all of that social mapping, that's crazy. And there's no such thing as hard delete either. Like you can say I deleted things, but we all know you can always pull things back later if you need to. So yeah, I think if people find out about this sort of thing, it would, yeah, I think there'd have to be some civil liberties questions would have to be raised in that.
That's why I think it's a win and a fail. It's interesting that the tech companies are pitching in and trying to do something, but you do worry about the long-term impacts of this kind of stuff and where it leads to, you know, the loss of our liberty and how that impacts everything. And also, yeah, all the knock-on effects into schools, into education, everything. So yeah, scary, but it was interesting to see that.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, well, it's been an interesting conversation, Caitlin. I appreciate you taking time out of your day and your planning to come and share a bit of your wisdom with us. It's been good to hear for someone who's been in that traditional space and then left it to go to online and then come back to a more traditional workflow and where your brain is at and where your thinking is at around that.
Yeah, it's kind of exciting. I didn't think when I came back to teaching that I was going to get an opportunity to use my other skill set. So
yeah,
this is interesting term. Thanks very much.
Thanks again, guys, and look forward to seeing you on the next one, Mike.
Sure thing.
Thanks for listening. For more episodes and show notes, visit utb.fyi/outclassed.